Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm very excited to be talking to Patricia Daly, who is co-author of The Ketogenic Kitchen. It's the definitive book that tells you how to implement a ketogenic diet. In part one, we laid out the rationale for following a ketogenic diet. It's beneficial for a variety of conditions. This book in particular is geared towards cancer survivors. But there are benefits in terms of weight loss, diabetes, optimizing cholesterol, and neurological diseases. Some people are using it for dealing with dementia. It's been proven to be effective in certain types of epilepsy. And so let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts of implementing this kind of diet. Patricia, what are some of the foods that really need to be avoided?
Yeah, there's actually, funny enough, when I look at my list, and again, we have one in the book as well, the sort of absolute no foods, they're actually the most obvious ones. So it's obviously all the processed foods that you would buy in a shop. So biscuits and cakes and sandwiches and muffins, cupcakes, all those, or even, you know, things like croissants or also bread. And then, you know, snack foods like popcorn, for instance, would definitely be out as well, or tortilla chips, and any type of grains, really. I mean, we also talk about the grains that are gluten-free, so a lot of people are actually surprised to hear that. They're sort of, wow, I can't even eat millet or buckwheat mm-hmm. or quinoa.
Right.
And I said, no, especially at the beginning, and if you are on a very strict ketogenic diet, these are definitely out. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, things that people have to really look out for. I don't like processed meat at all. So, anything, you know, or also fish, anything with preservatives and additives, I very much encourage people to stay away from, because again, there's also sugar, some sort of sugar, added. And it's just, we do have quite a lot of evidence into the processed meats in terms of, cancer, especially. And I don't think they're necessarily good for anyone.
Mm-hmm. And that may be why some of the studies suggest that meat is the culprit in cancers.
Yeah,
they just don't differentiate.
Yeah.
You know, the studies are compromised yeah. because they lump together, you know, hot dogs yeah. and bologna and, you know, luncheon meat along with grass-fed, you know, organic, natural animal products.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you go and ask the people who actually do those studies and you ask, so what about liver? They just mm-hmm. look at you as if you had seven heads. And so that's just all these foods, they're just totally not taken into consideration. And they just, as you say, they just put them all into the same pot. And that's not the way. You really have to very clearly differentiate if you implement a ketogenic diet, or actually for anybody who has cancer, I think it's really important to know the different types of meat and where they come from. And then there's other things like legumes. So a lot of people, so we call them pulses over here. So that's your chickpeas or your, you know, all types of beans, apart from the green beans. They're okay, actually. But also, you know, for instance, black beans or red beans or all of those. They're pretty much out as well. I sometimes sprout mung beans, for instance, or also chickpeas.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, you have
they're lower in carbohydrates when they're sprouted.
Yeah, exactly. And they have a lot more nutrients. Plus, you wouldn't eat more than a handful. You just simply can't.
Right.
They are quite bitter, but they are full of nutrients. So I say, okay, probably not at the beginning, but down the line, that's something that people can easily incorporate. So if they really miss their legumes, and you know, some people do a vegan ketogenic diet,
mm-hmm.
which can be very challenging. It is doable. It's not something I recommend necessarily people just do, but there are people who, for ethical reasons, they don't go near animal food. So I have to obviously think outside the box.
Yeah,
there,
that's challenging.
So they all come in there, exactly. And then milk is out as well. You know, artificially sweetened food or beverages, of any kind. So all the diet sodas as well. Sauces and dressings are notoriously high in sugar. So unless you find sort of a specific, a paleo type dressing or a really good one without any sugar, then that's out of the question as well.
Mm-hmm.
And fruit, unfortunately, Really only we're talking about very small quantities. So right. I, for instance, it's blackberry season here at the moment. So I do have a bit of blackberries, but again, they're the tiny ones, the wild ones, and you actually, they're more bitter and sour rather than sweet. So I eat that kind of thing when I go, you know, foraging with the kids or whatever. If I can get berries, wild berries especially, then I eat them, but I wouldn't go in with, you know, bananas and melons right. and apples. And, you know, it's really only in very, very small quantities.
Now, some people might question the need for such a fanatical adherence to this type of diet, you know, with such scrupulous avoidance of carbohydrates. But really, it's necessary to restrict your carb intake so that your body switches gears and uses fat as a fuel. Your own body fat gets burned down, but also the fat is a calorie source in the food as opposed to the readily available sugar. And it's actually fairly easy to undermine the effectiveness of a ketogenic diet with fairly small amounts of carbohydrates. So if you have, say, a starchy vegetable, you know, maybe, you know, it's a vegetable, but it's still going to prevent you from staying in ketosis.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, especially starchy vegetables, they are on my list here to limit. It's foods to definitely have, but only in smaller quantities and maybe not every day. So among those are starchy vegetables, but you know, things like sweet potato, for instance, they are incredibly carby. And the interesting thing is as well, I mean, I've been doing this now for over 4 years. And at the beginning, I had to be a lot more careful. I mean, you know, just the smallest little bit. I remember baking a cake for my daughter's birthday. That was in November, and I had started back in May. And it was a cake that was made. It was avocado and a little bit of date. And I just had a tiny bit just to try it. And I just got dizzy, and I got a lot of, you know, pretty nasty symptoms immediately. Whereas, you know, now I think my body is really properly fat adapted. And I think there's a difference that we have to emphasize as well. It's being in ketosis and being properly fat adapted.
Okay.
So initially, maybe for the first 6 months, you are going into ketosis. Sometimes you come out of it, especially when you overdo it on something, or you're learning. I mean, that's what I always say to the patients. You are learning. And, you know, it happens sometimes that you do eat, you know, a carrot soup, and you have too much, and you didn't know. You thought carrots were brilliant. And it just happens. It's part of it all, unless you really are very strictly supervised from the beginning, which obviously for epilepsy, for instance, is absolutely crucial. But then after a while, your body really becomes properly fat adapted, which means fat is the preferred fuel and it doesn't go for glucose that easily anymore. And I see that in myself quite a bit, that I can eat more carbs now than I used to, and it doesn't have the same effect. It wouldn't, you know, when I measure my ketones, then they're not as affected as they used to be. And I always sort of say to people as well, when they say, oh God, it takes so long to get fat adapted and everything throws me out and it's really frustrating. And I say, look, when I started this, I was 32. So I was glucose burning for 32 years. Mm-hmm. I can't expect my body to just, you know, relearn and forget right. everything and just be properly trained to burn a different fuel within weeks. I think we really have to be patient as well. And again, some people it doesn't suit. And that can happen as well, that somebody just simply does not thrive on that much fat. And then we have to revise. I mean, it can have to do with genetic, you know, polymorphisms as well, SNPs. And then we have to, you know, go back to the drawing board. And that can happen. I haven't seen it happen that much, but right. there are certain people who then have to go down on the fats, and then it's really rejigging everything.
So the emphasis is actually not, a lot of people think this is a particularly high protein diet. There is a fair amount of protein, but the object is not so much to boost the protein, it's to get adequate protein, but to use fat as a fuel. Yeah. So what kind of ratio are you seeking in planning meals? of fat to protein. You're aiming for virtually zero carbs, but the two remaining macronutrients, fat and protein, where do you go percentage wise?
Yeah, basically fat is, it's between 75 and 80, sometimes 85%, but that's already, I find that's really high and it's possibly not sustainable. I mean, the classical 4-to-1 ratio from the epileptic world is 90% fat.
Wow.
And in my view, I actually had a dietitian contacted me the other day and said, how do you get people to comply to a 4-to-1? And I said, I don't do 4-to-1.
Right.
I just, I'm trying to keep the whole picture for me, micros. So the vitamins, the minerals, the phytonutrients are really almost equally important than the macros. So I do tend to, and you can see in my book as well, there's always for every day, there's the ratios and for each single recipe as well. So it is, tends to be between 75 and 85, and protein is sort of between 12 and max 20% of total calorie intake. So somebody who maybe has just had surgery or who is exercising quite a lot. So I have quite a lot of athletes or ex-athletes who are going through cancer and they're still used to exercising quite a lot. So I'm the same, and I do resistance training. So I have a little bit more protein, especially on the day that I train. And then carbs are, on a strict ketogenic diet, which I work towards with a cancer patient, it's 12 grams, and that's about 4 or 5% of total calories. But that can go up then to 10 or so, depending on how somebody adapts.
Give us an idea what 12 grams represents nutritionally in terms of a cup of fruit or a candy bar or chocolate.
Oh, goodness. It really is nothing. I mean, I think I know in terms of, I just looked up quinoa the other day, and I think it's a good sort of a heaped tablespoon, is 12 grams.
That would give you your, that would give you your calories. So that's how stringent you have to be. So.
Yeah. Exactly,
what are the sources of good fats? I mean, obviously, you're not recommending that people dip in the Crisco jar or pour themselves a tall glass of corn oil. So what are the sources of healthy fat for fuel?
Yeah, and that's a very important question, because I have come more and more to the conclusion that, the type of fat is absolutely crucial, and especially getting the DHA, and that's particularly important for brain cancer patients as well. And I consider myself, it's the eye is an extension of the brain, so I'm very, very careful with DHA, so a type of omega-3. So looking at the ratio omega-3, omega-6, in my view, for cancer patients is really important as well. So if somebody eats nuts and seeds, to bear in mind, okay, I have to balance those omega-6s out with fish, for instance, that contain omega-3 fatty acids. So for instance, anchovy, sardines, mackerel, all those, salmon as well, all those omega-3 rich, foods, and to some extent also chia seeds or flax seeds, hemp seeds. But
I eat a lot of those. I have a lot of chia seeds in my berry dessert. It's one of my favorite things, with coconut milk and some chia seeds and a few berries.
Yeah, exactly. So they work really well for somebody who's constipated, for instance. And they're absolutely brilliant. And then, you know, the saturated fats, they do get a lot of bad press still, unfortunately. But I am convinced that on a ketogenic diet, you can't just have the polyunsaturates. It's just not going to work, especially if you want to keep that, a good ratio as well. So monounsaturates, are brilliant as well. So olive oil, and I also like, macadamia oil or macadamias. And
coconut oil is part of this.
And then coconut, would be, mainly saturated then, obviously. And the avocados are, there's quite a lot of monounsaturated as well. So they're all brilliant. And I always try to get as much fat as possible from whole foods without using too much oil, or, I try to eat olives as well and not just have the olive oil. So having a good mix of fatty foods. So also I love duck, for instance. So fatty meat is okay as well. Not that I would eat it every day, as we said earlier. But if I do go for meat, I try to, if I have a chicken, for instance, I have, you know, the skin as well, and I have the leg and not the breast. So all these things, they sort of, they help then to reach that, high, fat content. And some people are actually surprised how easy it is to, you know, if you make a good dressing with a bit of tahini, so that's, you know, ground sesame, so sesame paste, and I add olive oil there, and I thin it down with water, lots of garlic and turmeric, so I'm a big fan of using herbs and mm-hmm. spices as well. So, you know, you fairly easily then reach your fat target then with a bit of knowledge and good recipes and, you know, just tracking your macros a little bit.
Indeed. So how do you know that it's working? In other words, how do you know that you're reaching your target goal of being fat adapted or in ketosis?
Yeah, there's three different types of ketone bodies, and then there's also three different types of tracking them. And the gold standard is the blood ketones, so the beta hydroxybutyrate, which we can monitor with. It's basically the diabetic kit. And in the States, I think it's the Precision Extra. Over here, it's the Freestyle Optium Neo that I usually use. There's quite a lot more coming on the market now, but that's
so.
Sort of
so in other words, you use the equipment that diabetics use, but you just use a different stick, and it'll actually register with that same device.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, diabetics, it's really exactly the same thing, even the same sticks, because diabetics, they usually get ketone strips as well, because if their glucose is outside the range, mm-hmm. they should really measure their ketones as well, just to see are they getting into, you know, the diabetic ketoacidosis.
Which is the bad kind of ketosis. That's the dangerous kind.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Which is still constantly mixed up, which is very frustrating. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it is still, people still confuse nutritional ketosis with the ketoacidosis, the diabetic, or it can happen in alcohol addicts as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the gold standard. And, you know, nutritional ketones.
Actually, it will give you a numerical readout, because I know that in the old days, they used to give people keto sticks. They would dip them in the urine, and it was a colorimetric test, but it was a little inaccurate because it just gave you a general range. They would turn purple or dark purple, but that was a very kind of, you know, rough way of estimating your level of ketosis.
Yeah, correct. And what I say to my clients is use them at the very beginning, because chances are you're not producing blood ketones yet. Mm-hmm. And you excrete ketones through the urine. And in the first 2 weeks, most people, you know, it's enough for them to see if they are starting to produce ketones generally. And then they can use the urine strips, and that's fine. But then once, actually quite often you sort of get panicky calls, Patricia, my ketones have disappeared. I said, okay, did you do the urine? And yeah, so it can happen that they just simply don't excrete them anymore through the urine, and they're being utilized, which is what we want.
Right.
And
so it isn't necessarily bad. It just means that, you know, maybe you've gotten to the next stage of fat adaptation.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And then it's interesting. I am sort of trying out, you know, the acetone, the ketonics that measures acetone. So that's the ketone body that we can measure in the breath. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's different devices, but sort of the most common and the most popular one that has been on the market for a while is the ketonics. And I recommend getting the one, the sport one, the red one, because it goes higher in terms of the measurements than the standard one. Mm-hmm. And it is really what it sort of reflects in a way what is being utilized, really, what is being metabolized, whereas in the blood, it's more, not storage is probably the wrong word, but sort of what comes closest to storage. And if that conversion doesn't happen, so if somebody has, you know, very, very high beta hydroxybutyrate in the blood and then has no acetone in the breath, then I start to wonder, are actually those ketone bodies, are they really being used up for metabolism, or is there a problem? Mm-hmm. are the ketones not getting into the mitochondria? So that's when I start to just ask people to look at some patterns. You know, when you measure your block ketones, measure your breath as well and see if you can find out a pattern. And it can be very individual, but there are certain rules of thumb that I found that, you know, give me a good indication. And if somebody just doesn't produce the breath ketones, then I investigate a bit further what's going on.
You know, so it sounds like it's relatively safe, not dangerous, but it sounds like it can be a little dicey, and it might call for, I mean, this book is a great self-help resource, but if you're going to undertake this, and or if you have a serious medical condition, it might be advisable to get a professional help from a nutritionist who's familiar with this regime.
Definitely, and we actually emphasize that throughout the book, that please don't do that on your own, even just, you know, to do the baseline blood tests, which I'm absolutely adamant about when I work with clients, because I just, first of all, we need to see if there's progress. We need to know what cholesterol levels were before we started, because somebody can come after a month and say, oh, I started a ketogenic diet. Look, my LDL is really high. Right. My HDL is really low. And I was like, okay, what was it before? Maybe it's actually come down, but it's still high. So you always have to have something to compare it with. So before starting, get the baselines, even just to exclude anything. I mean, somebody could be pre-diabetic or diabetic and doesn't know. And then, you know, it needs a difference. They need different support as well. So it's really important to get those tests done, to learn how to monitor and to just get a bit of hand-holding, to be honest, as well. I think that's really important, and especially just to make sure there's absolutely no contraindication. I mean, we list them in our book as well, but I guess to a lot of people, they just mean nothing. Obviously, those who would have one of those metabolic conditions would know, but still it's important to have them and have somebody just walking people through that again. Okay, there's definitely nothing that prevents them from implementing a ketogenic diet. But we always say, please just don't do that in a sneaky way, not telling your oncologist, because they really need to know. And we are hoping with, you know, more research coming out, more clinical trials in humans, that more and more oncologists will actually understand what it's all about and how it can support their work, how it can actually improve the effectiveness of chemotherapy and also radiotherapy. And that's where my big hope lies.
Indeed. And looking at the wonderful pictures and the wonderful recipes, it looks like, well, there's some deprivation, but there's a lot of delicious options here. I'm looking at nut porridge, egg-free bread, an egg-free sandwich, bacon with vegetables, cauliflower puree. Cauliflower, a good alternative to potatoes for those who miss potatoes. And zucchini spaghetti as an alternative to wheat pasta, egg-free bread, very, very interesting and ingenious recipes to make it doable. So the book is The Ketogenic Kitchen. The authors, Dominique Kemp, and today's guest, Patricia Daly. And Patricia, is there a website where people can get more information?
Yeah, we have a website, theketogenickitchen.com, where we actually have to be honest, we have to add more updates, but there is some good information. And then also on patriciadaly.com, and that will lead people then to ketoforyou.com, where I actually do courses for practitioners, but also for patients. And I'm just actually really changing everything around to do membership, a monthly membership, to make it accessible to more people financially as well, but also to have ongoing support for those who wish for. And I think especially practitioners, I would love them to, you know, start writing case studies and really support each other across the world. I think that's how we can best then learn from each other and learn for our patients.
Well, congratulations. You know, you've taken a challenging personal situation and you've turned it into a wonderful vocation and a wonderful service to the community of people who are struggling with challenging diseases. So appreciate very much you coming on, and all the
Thank
best.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks you too. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Patricia Daly, and the website ketoforyou.com, the book, The Ketogenic Kitchen. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.